I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
The championship season is over, and what a season it was.
But the best is yet to come. It's the playoffs.
Who will make it to the Premier League?
And who will be left heartbroken at Wembley?
Stay across it all with the second tier.
We're bringing you episodes after every leg.
And in between, we're revisiting the greatest moments in playoff history.
It's real conversation with two real championship obsessives.
So you can be in the know about everything happening in the playoffs.
And share all your new knowledge in the pub with your mates.
So come join us.
We're your one-stop shop for the playoffs.
Search second tier in your podcast app
and hit subscribe.
Welcome to On the Continent, your definitive guide to the week in European football. I'm Andy Brassel.
I'm Lars Watson.
And I'm Jonathan Johnson.
On this edition, all my dreams have come true this week, ladies and gents. No, not because I'm sitting in the big chair pretending to be Dotton, but because the back end of the Champions League has turned into the NBA playoffs. Twists, turns, high intensity, and who knows, maybe even two Bundesliga teams set for the final at Wembley. Though there's every chance yet that Kylian Mbappe ends up playing against his future club at the home of football instead. That's not the only European trophy on offer, of course. And have we overlooked the claims of one of France's giants to get their hands on more continental silverware? Not for much longer if everybody's ex-Arsenal speedster has his way. We look south and examine the Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang revival. Fellas, now we've seen PSG at a disadvantage in the Champions League semi-final before, JJ. I'm not sure we quite expected it to go like this, did we? Them coming away from Dortmund with a 1-0 deficit. And it's one of those games where the score really didn't describe the game whatsoever.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it certainly merited to be a higher scoring match. I think Dortmund will certainly feel that they didn't score more than once, but equally will be very grateful that PSG didn't. I mean, there were some glaring opportunities missed. Fulkrug, had a handful of opportunities, arguably scored the hardest one. When you're thinking about the PSG chances, you've got the both posts being hit inside of 30 seconds in the second half. You've got that Ousmane Dembele miss as well. So, you know, there are plenty of opportunities on either side. And if we get that many chances for the second leg, I think the odds would be quite favourable that we'd have more goals. So, a very keenly contested game. I wouldn't say I was completely stunned that PSG didn't win. I did think that they would probably come away with a draw because their away form has been pretty solid, certainly since they lost to Milan about 6 months ago now. But, at the end of the day, we've seen, a one-goal deficit doesn't faze PSG. This time, though, they've got to turn it around at home, which in theory should be an easier task for them than turning it around away from home, as was the case in the quarterfinals against Barca.
And it's important, isn't it, Lars, that idea of looking into the actual content of the game rather than just the result, because Dortmund, clean sheets ahoy in the Champions League, 5 clean sheets in the Champions League, which is remarkable because sometimes it's difficult to imagine them keeping a clean sheet for 15 minutes. But even if some of the defending was a bit harum scarum, everyone was fully committed. I mean, is this a good example of why Dortmund struggle a little bit in the Bundesliga sometimes, but really flourish in cup competitions under Edin Terzic?
Well, there seems to be something about the Champions League in particular and these big nights that's bringing out a different level from this Dortmund team, because you look at this performance and you look at the home performance against Atletico Madrid, and Dortmund fans could be forgiven for asking, like, where is this when we're playing like Stuttgart or whoever in the domestic league, because they've been very inconsistent in the Bundesliga, and I say inconsistent, they've often just been quite bad and underwhelming. But there is something about these nights in Europe where they seem to raise their game. And I thought it was interesting if you look at the players who really dominated or really played well yesterday. Like, we'll get to Jadon Sancho. But also, like, guys like Sabitzer and Emre Can and Mats Hummels, like, the guys who are meant to be carrying the load for this team, the guys who are meant to be the senior pros, who so often have just been a little bit disappointing domestically, really kind of got it together. And it is kind of a... It's an old cliche, but there does seem to be something about these evening European games under the lights in front of a full Signal Iduna Park that really gets everyone's minds focused and sharpened, and they look like a different team.
While we talk about the defensive element of it, obviously Dortmund lost one big Norwegian. I mean, they've got another in Julian Ryerson, who is a bit of an unsung hero, but... like, he is legitimately one of the best Norwegians in the world now, isn't he?
Yeah, I think he is really kind of an unsung hero in Norway as well, because he's kind of an unassuming guy, and he's kind of an unassuming player. And he is that rarest of... well, I mean, when Dortmund signed him from Union Berlin, I thought it was kind of almost like a throwback signing, because he seemed like a kind of guy who would, for instance, thrive in the Jurgen Klopp team, because he's not... technically not a genius. Yeah. Like, he's not a swashbuckling attacking fullback, but he's a really committed hard worker who won't get many performances that are under 6 out of 10 out of him. You're not gonna get many 10 out of 10s either, but like, he does what it says on the tin, and I think that's not a bad thing to have, at least on one of your sides, as a fullback, someone who's committed, works hard, is a good defensive player. You know, bearing in mind when he came to Germany, he was a transfer. He left his home club in Norway, Viking, from Stavanger. He left them to go abroad when they were in the second tier in Norway and went to Union Berlin, who were then in the Zweite Bundesliga, right? So this was a transfer that started out as from the second tier in Norway to the second tier in Germany. And he kind of worked his way up with the sort of Union Berlin rise and marked himself out as a solid and reliable performer for them. But I actually thought it was quite imaginative of Dortmund to pick up a guy like that. And maybe this is something they could do occasionally, because it tends to be with Dortmund, their recruitment model tends to be they're trying to sign the stars of tomorrow and they're trying to have a couple of experienced guys to back them up. With Ryerson, it's more like he's a perfectly fine squad player who does a good job for you. Turns out, even at the height, even as high as in the Champions League semi-final, but not very glamorous. But I thought he was very good, and it's interesting to me as a Norwegian, because obviously in our country we talk a lot about Erling Haaland and Martin Ødegaard. There's not a lot of Ryerson chat, but there he is in the Champions League when the other lads have gone out.
I can't wait for the Ryerson book in 6 months' time when they finally do lift the trophy at Wembley last. But, you know, when you're talking about Dortmund making the right signings rather than the glamorous signings, I think both him and Niklas Füllkrug are a good example of that. They're not really underlining a coherent transfer policy or a good transfer policy. They're just a couple they've stumbled upon. And you were pointing them out before, JJ. Füllkrug playing his first season in European competition, 31 years old, as unglamorous as centre forwards get. And he looks like he belongs in this company, and he could be huge for Germany at the Euros as well.
I know it's overused as a cliche, but you know, he is very much the definition of a late bloomer, both in terms of sort of his rise at club level, but also internationally. And I don't know if it occurred to you guys, it certainly wasn't lost on me, but the type of goal was very, very similar to Erling Haaland's, with a bit less power to the one that he scored a couple of years ago back in 2020, a very low shot that blasts into the net. And, you know, that, funnily enough, is what PSG find themselves 4 years on, having to sort of undo the damage from, again, in the second level, but second leg. But in terms of Füllkrug's impact, he has a physical presence that, you know, is able to pull defenses, you know, around, you know, and completely pick them apart at times. And I think you look at the difficulties that he gave Lucas Hernandez, who obviously had to go off before half time, and then his replacement, Lucas Bernal, not being that convincing since joining PSG. Even Marquinhos, you know, with all the experience that he's accrued over his time with PSG, you know, struggled at times. I remember him having to make one last last gasp intervention to prevent what probably would have been a second at some point. I think it was in the second half. Fulkrug, I think, he's a real handful for teams because there's so much of him. It's really, really difficult to get somebody on him and properly sort of shackle him. He's still such an unknown quantity for a lot of these teams because it's not like he's carved himself out this reputation where people know what he's going to do, what his trademark move is. It's just this bundle of sheer sort of power. But you know, he's a guy who can also move as well. It's a little bit like Sula in the defense. You look at him, you don't think he's going to be fast. I mean, I'm not saying he's an Olympic sprinter, but you know, he can move rapidly for somebody of that build. And I think he is a very, very tricky customer, and PSG experienced that. And you know, he will now be a marked man certainly going into that second leg. But again, you know, PSG perhaps should have been maybe more aware of that, given that they did have two group stage encounters against Dortmund earlier in the season.
I would also say that they should be aware of it, given that the reputation is the PSG players usually very much keen on a full Krug, whether that is a bottle or a glass or...
I tried that joke on Twitter/X a few months ago, and it didn't seem to go down well, but I'm very appreciative of it.
It didn't work that well for me last night either. It just got like 10 likes or something. It was not hardly worth it.
I'm gonna go and search for it.
Listen, I'm all about the green shift, lads. You need some sustainable you need to recycle things occasionally. You know, it's just sustainable. I've said this before on the pod. You know, you can't just use a joke once. You need to try to find multiple uses.
But Lars, it turns out that everything sounds better on OTC, and it turns out that Jadon Sancho is always much better at Dortmund. I mean, the explosion of joy, particularly in England, about his performance, and let's make no mistake, this is by far his best performance since he's returned to Signal Iduna Park. And maybe that was something that was missed in the delirium of him performing so well and him having Nuno Mendes on toast and making life so difficult for PSG. The fact that it's not been easy since he's come back. And in fact, as recently as a week ago, or less than a week ago, Edin Terzic saying Jadon knows that he's not where he wants to be at the moment, that he's not as good as he wants to be at the moment, but we're working on it and he will get there. And of course, Terzic and Sancho are quite close. But this was a tantalizing little, yeah, okay, he's still got it, and he's still got it in these really big moments, JJ.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think as well, sort of for Sancho to get to the level of performance that he reached on Wednesday, you have to bear in mind where he came from and the lack of football he had certainly in his last 6 months at United. And I think I read again on social media, some people observing that he had a quiet sort of first 20, 25 minutes. But what I noticed every time was the defensive shift he was putting in, dispossessing Nuno Mendes on the left. I think really was an underrated part of that performance as well, because we're going to marvel about how great he was going forward. And he was really touring to PSG at times and, almost kind of deserved at least a second goal for at least one of the opportunities that he managed to carve open for the hosts. You know, I think it was, it's not a huge surprise to those of us who knew what he was capable of at Dortmund and saw flashes of it as well against United. And to see him back, certainly as an Englishman, is very encouraging. If not ahead of the Euros, then actually, you know, ahead of the 2026 World Cup, if he can get his future sorted. And it certainly looks like it would be a good idea to extend his stay in Dortmund, if at all possible. It's one of those things where I think, now that he's got that confidence flowing, now he's seen that he can bring that kind of performance out of the locker once again. Who knows? Maybe it's the moment where he can go from strength to strength, you know, go back to actually focusing what he does best on the pitch, as opposed to that sort of war of attrition that he was locked in against Ten Hag United.
And I think the selflessness of the performance is quite important. And last we saw that from Karim Adeyemi on the other side, a player who maybe is not so much in focus for an English audience, but ended last season brilliantly when they nearly won the league and has gone sideways this season, partly through injury, but a real lack of form, lack of discipline on some occasions as well, like daft red cards and that sort of stuff, like the one he received going back a couple of weeks. And I just think with him, the defensive effort was there from minute one. And it's clear that Dortmund are not good defensively to live with PSG if they're just defending with a four or a six. It needs to be all of them, doesn't it? There needs to be total buy-in.
And this might be part of the key to what I kind of was talking about earlier in the episode now, about how they seem to be a different animal on these big nights. Maybe one of the things that makes a difference is that everyone, even the attacking players, put in just a little bit more of a shift off the ball than they would do if they were playing like Heidenheim or someone. Like it just changes the mentality a little bit. Adeyemi has been a really frustrating one, because I think when he was brought in from Salzburg, I think everyone just kind of assumed that, okay, they've done it again. This is the next Haaland, the next Bellingham, the next Sancho, whatever, because he showed so much promise in Austria and he hasn't kicked on, and injuries have played a part, but he just hasn't added layers to his game. He's still very, very fast. We can see that. He can be direct, but he can be a very frustrating player. But I do think that skill set, and maybe we'll touch on it a little bit when we get to the Real Madrid game, in games like this, I think it's underrated to have guys who are just incredibly fast and will sort of run in behind, because you're coming up against teams who want to attack you, who want to establish themselves higher up the field. And having that sort of rapid pace really unsettles them. Even if he's not playing well, he doesn't have to play well. He just needs to be there and be fast. And it gives the defender something to worry about that kind of, you know, puts the fear into them a little bit.
JJ, if we're talking about how PSG are going to turn this around in, 6 days' time now, how are they going to do it? Is there something to be taken from what Dortmund did in going horses for courses? You know, the sort of players that are going to perform the role that's going to get you what you want. I mean, it's interesting to see them bring on Randall Colomwani, for example, for Bradley Barcola, who has been brilliant, really, in the second half of this season and was particularly good in the away leg at Barcelona. Didn't really happen for him last night. But it felt as if they went to like for like, when maybe Gonzalo Ramos would have mixed it up a little bit. What do you think that Luis Enrique can draw from what didn't happen in Dortmund for what he needs to happen in the return in Paris?
Well, I don't think I'm going to necessarily petition for some sort of David Odonkor approach as Lars was just mentioning there for on the Dortmund side of things. I mean, I think there are going to be certain considerations PSG have to make now. I mean, Lucas Hernandez, that looks like a worrying injury, not just in terms of the second leg, but possibly the Euros for France as well. That's going to be a big miss, because for my money, he's been one of the most consistent performers for PSG. So immediately a bit of a challenge defensively. Like I said, Beraldo's not been convincing. You do have an experienced head like Danilo, but not a natural central defender. So that's already one sort of challenge. And also then you have the Kylian Mbappe conundrum, where you need his goals, so it's natural to start him through the middle, but there's no denying that he was better against Dortmund once he moved slightly out wide, which sort of necessitated the, you know, bringing Barcola off and putting Colomwani on. Now, if Luis Enrique wants to go out, you know, and immediately try to get the goal back and then you know, hit the front and go ahead in the tie, I think having a goal threat on like Gonzalo Ramos makes a lot of sense. Sure, that means you might have to rejig the three. We've seen Dembele sort of gravitate towards a more central position in Europe anyway, whether that's just because he's wearing the number 10 shirt or he feels like that his best way of influencing the team going forward. You know, but some of his better performances on the continental stage have certainly come in that sort of number 10 role. And maybe the way for Luis Enrique to go about it is perhaps to keep somebody like Barcola for the impact that he had, that we saw in the first leg against Barca and the second leg, and just try to go out with as much goal threat as possible. Because starting Gonzalo Ramos now, or at least giving him say at least half an hour of the game makes a lot more sense now that he's fit. It was impossible to take that kind of gamble in the first half of the season during the group stages. But equally, Luis Enrique seems to be comfortable enough gambling on somebody so out of form in Kolo Muani. Doesn't have that same sort of confidence in front of goal, yet sort of put him out there, almost asking him to put a shift in without really expecting him to provide too much of a goal threat, you know, just aside from sort of providing perhaps a more direct route to goal. So I certainly think that that's going to be a major consideration for Luis Enrique. And in terms of how he sets the team up, I know technically Fabian Ruiz can be a massive asset at times. His finishing was woeful, but you don't expect anything from him. But you do wonder if it's maybe the moment that PSG gamble on Ugarte to sort of anchor the midfield. And then that way you get the absolute most from Vitinha and Warren Zaire-Emery without sort of having to worry about, you know, if Ruiz is going to misplace one of his passes. I found Ruiz's performance very Verratti-esque, actually. He was doing a lot of fancy footwork close to his own goal, you know, playing balls across to the other side of the pitch, which fantastic when they came off. But in terms of giving away possession, you know, highly risky. And I think PSG need a bit of a more no-nonsense approach going into that second leg.
All that was really needed was for him to sort of spontaneously injure himself and head off to the nightclub, I guess, to really sort of fulfill the Verratti role.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your processes to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart. Schedule package pickups and see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers. With rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Sign up with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Thomas Tuchel, what an incredible week for him at the head of Bayern. Of course, received news of that petition that some fans wanted him to stay, Xavi style, in a press conference last week. Then there was the huge public spat with Uli Hoeneß, which Max Eberl, the new Bayern head of sport, sort of had his first major crisis to unpick in separating those two before the start of the biggest game of the season, the home leg of the Champions League semi-final against Real Madrid. And globally, we saw a lot of good Thomas Tuchel in this, didn't we, Lars?
Yeah, certainly the way in which he changed the game, I thought, at halftime with Guerrero coming on for Goretzka, they definitely came out in the second half with a, you know, as really made a change. This also, I remember thinking this in the second half. I'm generally not a huge believer in like the sort of thunderous halftime team talk. I kind of feel like that side of coaching might be a little bit overestimated. I think the players are pretty fired up, are pretty motivated, and all this sort of stuff. But I do wonder if this is one of the cases where I'd like to know what was said. I'd like to have been a fly on the wall in the dressing room at Bayern, because I just thought they had a completely different sort of energy to them and approach in the second half. They were attacking things much more. They were running with the ball. They were just kind of looking more confident. They looked a much better side in the second half. And that it's very tempting and perhaps rational then to point to the coach and say he must have done some good work there. And I guess there's no... In the great Thomas Tuchel discourse, there's really no doubt, I think, that he's a clever tactician and a good coach. Like, that isn't what's going wrong for him at various clubs. It's other stuff that maybe we'll get to later in the segment. But it seemed like a good example of Tuchel having a positive impact on a game for his team.
I mean, that was the unusual thing, wasn't it, really, JJ? In this last week, the way he responded to Uli Hoeneß. Hoeneß, of course, criticised him in public at that panel for Frankfurter Allgemeine. And said he doesn't develop young players. He doesn't believe you can improve Musiala or Alphonso Davies. He just wants to go and buy another player. And Thomas Tuchel appeared quite hurt by that. He said it pricked his coaching honour, I think were the words he used. And he sort of defended himself and talked about young players he had brought through. And it's interesting, a moment like this, when Tuchel, you think, oh, actually, he is capable of being the adult in the room. And then... after this game, where you see the full gamut of his tactical capability, he comes out and he says, oh yeah, Kim can't make mistakes like that, and totally coats off like his star centre-half in public after this massive game.
Yeah, I mean, I've not been one to know him throw players or high-profile players under the bus like that. But I guess maybe... fed by the fatalistic sort of attitude that Tuchel has had since basically being informed that their collaboration will go no further than the end of this season. Now, obviously, that hasn't changed at this moment in time, despite sort of a groundswell of support and speculation for Bayern actually sort of, you know, just looking at the situation and trying to make the best of it with Tuchel. Whether or not that's possible, you know, is a completely different debate. Now, in my experience of Tuchel and sort of having looked at sort of his career, it's very, very difficult to expect Tuchel and a club to have a long shelf life once there starts to be a bit of friction between the club's top brass and Tuchel himself. Mm. I do think he actually developed some young players as well. I mean, I know that he's lost in the annals of history now based on what's happened since he left PSG. But don't forget that Tanguy Nianzou looked like a fantastic prospect when Tuchel bled him and was willing to play him in some big games, you know, even in Europe as well.
It's funny. I've heard Thomas Tuchel blamed for a lot of things. I've not heard him blamed before for financially ruining Sevilla, which he obviously did by making it look as if they should pay 20 million for Tanguy Nianzou. But JJ, I think you talked about it there, the idea that Tuchel could actually stay. I mean, we're hearing, as we record, that Ralf Rangnick, who was the favourite, the only candidate, as Max Ebel said, for the Bayern job, has turned them down and decided to stay with Austria. Now, why has Bayern become such an unattractive job? And are we talking about the possibility of Tuchel staying because simply no one else will take it, which is not that dissimilar to the situation at Barcelona, for example?
I mean, my personal opinion on the matter is, yes, I think the scenario of Thomas Tuchel staying on and continuing with Bayern should be considered, despite the comments about Kim and the tension with the leadership. I think something good made out of that tension. I think the reason why Bayern is suddenly a job that so many high-profile coaches are steering away from is that Bayern suddenly seems to have lost all kind of sense of identity, the sense of what made them great, what made them attractive, you know, what once was their power. In that they were this dominant force in German football, you know, is suddenly completely lost because they're making very un-Bayern decisions, you know, going through, you know, however many different managers it's been in the space of 18 months. That is extremely unlike Bayern Munich. They're not sort of the stable force that they once were. And I think that's why, you know, it's put so many people off of the job.
So I always thought Ralf Rangnick was a strange candidate for the job, not because what Bayern are looking for, there was no sense in this process at any point like that Bayern were going to hand the keys of the castle to Ralf Rangnick. Like, that's not what's happening here. They saw him as a steady hand on the till, like a placeholder, someone who's going to be in charge for maybe just a season until other more inspiring candidates become available. And I just think Rangnick is such a strange choice for that, because he's not like a pragmatic sort of craftsman. Like Rangnick's a visionary. Like he's more like, if you think of the sort of the Steve Jobs film that Aaron Sorkin wrote, the Michael Fassbender one, like Rangnick is much more the Steve Jobs character than like the Wozniak or the technicians who are kind of running around trying to make these big ideas actually function. Like Rangnick has the big ideas. And the last couple of coaches, managers at Bayern have all run into one of the problems they've all run into is that they want specific players for specific roles to suit their style. And they've been told by upstairs that, no, you can't have those players. Like, we have other players. This, you work with what's there. And we saw at Manchester United, like, I'm not necessarily blaming Rangnick for how badly that went, but we saw quite clearly that he came in with, like, I have this one vision of how we're going to play. And then he quickly identified that that doesn't work with that squad. And then it just drifted because he had no other fallback. Like, so him as a short-term sort of sensible guy to just maneuver them through, it doesn't make any sense. Like, and I wonder, we don't know his exact reasons for turning them down. Maybe he just feels that, like, hanging around in Austria and drinking Grüneveltiners and coaching very occasionally national team games is not a bad life. Sounds like a good life to me, compared to jumping into the sort of total snake pit in Bavaria. But I wonder if it's also, maybe he knows himself well enough to know that sort of like a short-term adventure there doesn't seem to make any sense.
I think the most frightening thing from a Bayern fan's perspective is that they were probably choosing him for the same reason as Manchester United were choosing him, in that you think you've got a coach who has more of a vision. So that brings a bit of calm to the situation, but it exposes the fact that there's a lack of leadership upstairs. And that's the problem with Bayern at the moment, isn't it? That there isn't that sort of firm leadership. You think Pep Guardiola went there and he loved it because you could just run the team. You didn't have to think about the other stuff. It was just the team. Whereas if you're getting it in Rangnick at this point, you're thinking, okay, well, we're getting someone who's experienced, who can look after the team, but maybe bridge some of the gap upstairs. And in fact, you end up falling between two stools and not getting sporting director Rangnick, which he's probably better at, and not getting a great coach either.
And one of the other situations that's very specific to Bayern that I always note is there's still players who are more important than the manager, or players whose opinions count more than whoever's in charge. Yeah. Thomas Müller, as much as I love him as a player, when he speaks, everybody goes along with it. I'm not necessarily saying what he says is wrong, but sort of, you know, having more leadership on the pitch from somebody like Müller than upstairs, you know, that is already quite alarming. And then you also have, you know, Manuel Neuer in goal, not the same force that he once was, but almost irreplaceable in terms of the identity that he stands for in the Bayern side.
I do wonder where it leaves Bayern, though, because we already knew that Rangnick was not plan A. I mean, he will have been plan C or D. But then he emerged as, like you said, someone they publicly endorsed as the only candidate. And then they get turned down by the sitting Austria manager, which is kind of embarrassing for Bayern Munich. This is not something that should happen to them. And are they, what happens now? Again, like, you don't want the Tuchel staying thing. I really wonder, because it seemed to me almost as if he seemed almost elated when it became published that he was leaving. Like, on the touchline, the next couple of games, and in his interviews, he just seemed like in a better mood when it was clear that he was leaving. Like, he was D-Mob happy. Like, he was out of there. And you could look at that game against Real Madrid, and you see the reaction he gets from the team, and he makes changes, and how well they played in the second half in particular. And it's easy to think, like, why would we even consider going from this to Ralf Rangnick? Like, that doesn't make any sense. But then you have the weird, the sort of post-match Kim weirdness. Like, Kim is a player who looks like he's lacking confidence. Like, obviously, he dropped a complete stinker against the Real Madrid. Laid an egg, as I believe a phrase goes, and made a couple of really bad mistakes. but looks uncertain, looks like he's lacking confidence. And Tuchel's response to this is just kind of embarrassing publicly by sort of meticulously picking through the mistakes he made for a global audience to enjoy, which is like, this is not good leadership. Like, what's happening here? So, I again, continuing with him seems like not something you would want to do. Are they going to chuck more money at Sebastian Hoeneß? Like, I don't know. It's a fascinating situation that, because where do you go?
Well, the one moment where Tuchel really did hit the nail on the head, where he talked about how Bayern had started really well in the first 15 minutes of this game, but then they did to us what they do to everyone else, which is a really good way of describing Real Madrid in the Champions League, I suppose. Toni Kroos had a particularly great first half, and you know he's really good at escaping from pressing despite his advancing years, someone who's really happy at receiving the ball under pressure. But JJ, if we're looking about how Real Madrid are going to go about winning this tie at the Bernabeu, have they got to find a way of getting Jude Bellingham in the game more? Because obviously he's had a more difficult 2024, not a bad 2024, but a more difficult 2024 than he did in the back half of 2023 when he arrived and absolutely wowed everyone. No one's questioning his status at Real Madrid or as one of the best players, maybe even the best player in the world. But if we're talking about best players in the world, this is something I've touched upon before. If you look at the early years of, say, Messi and Ronaldo's careers, they were accused of going missing in big matches. Now, Bellingham had plenty of touches in this game, but mainly in zones where Bayern would be quite happy for him to have the touches. Given that he was even maybe a nominal false nine, how do they get him involved more? Because this could really decide the tie, couldn't it?
Yeah, he could. And obviously, it was a bit of, I wouldn't say disappointment, but certainly sort of pre-match, I think we were all sort of hoping to see, you know, some sort of masterclass from Bellingham, and he wasn't sort of allowed the influence on the game to put in that kind of performance. But I think this also points to the problem that Real Madrid have, and that's sort of focal point of the attack, because I think to get the best out of Bellingham, you know, coming into that kind of almost like number 10 role is great, but sort of relying on him to almost, you know, be playing between a 10 and a, like you said, a false nine, it's almost kind of like a bridge too far. And also why I don't think that, I mean, obviously that's going to be me and my PSG bias talking, but I don't think that Kylian Mbappe will necessarily fix that problem either, because he has similar problems playing through the middle as well. You know, it feels like there's a void that all of those attacking players are trying to fill, and some of them do better jobs of it than others. But also, given the way that he's overperformed statistically this season, certainly domestically, I think that Bellingham marks himself out for a special kind of treatment, certainly in more attacking areas. And that also sort of contributes to him being, you know, quite muzzled at times in games like this, certainly against, you know, elite opposition, even if they're not elite in form at the moment in Bayern.
Makes you feel optimistic about life, doesn't it, when you think that Kylian Mbappe and Jude Bellingham have got plenty of stuff to work on. Another thing that makes you feel optimistic about life is the revival of Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, who everything looked as if it had gone sideways for him at Chelsea. Now, of course, he'll be involved in the semi-finals of the Europa League with Marseille. Tonight, as we are recording, they're playing against Atalanta. So much focus has been on the other semi-final between Roma and Leverkusen. Of course, a rerun of last year's Titanic one goal over two games semi-final. I'm sure Xabi Alonso is planning something entirely different for that. But what about Aubameyang? I mean, you have Marseille in this situation, JJ, where they've had a mess of a season, whereas he wasn't exactly warmly greeted either, because he was nominally replacing Alexis Sanchez, who's a very different sort of player, a sort of powder keg, someone who ignites the whole team. And Aubameyang's not necessarily that. But he's grown into the leader that they've needed, actually. And it's not just the numbers, of course. 27 goals and 9 assists, as we speak, in all competitions at 34, soon to be 35 years of age. But he has put in, I think the nine assist bit is quite important because he's put in so much work for the team. Highest number of assists he's had since he was at Saint-Etienne. And after being a player at Dortmund and Arsenal, who just, in inverted commas, scored the goals and had 15, 16 touches a game, he's sort of, it is a second childhood for him almost, isn't it?
It is. And I think sort of Aubameyang in like the post-Arsenal years is very easy to forget because of the chaos at Barca, that he actually had quite a decent period of like the twilight part of his career with Barca and then got sort of moved on as a victim of what was going on at Camp Nou at the time. Obviously, it was disastrous, almost an industrial accident of a transfer when he went to Chelsea. I had to crowbar that in because of the chat separate to this show about French cliches on whether transfers are simply just a casting error or if they go all the way up to level 10 out of 10 and be the industrial accident that we occasionally
I love
get
that.
To witness. But going back to the point industrial about Aubameyang, I mean, he was in that sort of territory of being considered an industrial accident at the beginning of Marseille career. And then suddenly it all started to click. And I think maybe because of the age and sort of form and fitness that, you know, it's more and more challenging to keep yourself in the shape that Aubameyang is in now. So it took him a bit longer to get going with Marseille. But I think what he brings to the table in terms of his experience, but also still his skill set, you know, I think it has been hugely important for Marseille because it's allowed him to be this source of consistency, which really Marseille on and off the pitch for years now just don't have. You know, they need that constant source of goals, you know, and reliable performers. And Aubameyang is the closest to that they have at this moment in time. Now that Marseille fans have kind of been won over by what Aubameyang can bring on and off the pitch, you know, the spectacular nature of the goals that he scores as well, rolling back the years, has helped hugely. But I think he's stepped in and filled a void. Few players who were on the transfer market at that time would have been able to do for Owen.
But Lars, if we go back to last summer, I mean, at the beginning of a season in which Marseille have been Marseille times 10, really, they've almost been a caricature of themselves in terms of the drama, in terms of the setbacks, all that sort of stuff. Aubameyang wasn't really a signing that should have worked, was he? Because he was, from a distance, the typical Marseille signing. They go and pay him a ton of money, that even if he's taken a pay cut from his previous big deals at Arsenal and to a lesser extent Barcelona, he's earning a fair chunk of change for Marseille. And they've gone for a name because he'd been kicking his heels at Chelsea, really. And they've so often in the past gone for names rather than the right players. Yet in this season of chaos, he's managed to find some sort of clarity. I mean, in terms of him stepping up and being that all-round player that he hasn't been for a really long time, is it just because like there's no one else to do it? You know, he's not landed in a great team, so he's almost been forced to take on this responsibility, do you think?
But I think that's a good description of the circumstances, but I'm still surprised that he's actually gone and done it, because I was pretty exasperated with him. John is right to point out that Barcelona stint was actually better than certainly a lot of people expected at the time, and maybe better than it's remembered, just because Barcelona has been such a, in the word of one of our listeners a couple of weeks ago, such a clown house in recent times. Love that phrase. Forget the name of the guy who sent that in, but that was wonderful. A clown house. Yeah, but no, that was a sign. That was a reminder that there's still a player here. But I think it's so much of this must be about him and his motivation and what he wants to do with what's left of his career, because he just looks like a completely different player. And I was worried about him because so much of what he does well is about that sort of rapid burst of speed that he has. He's 34 now, not going to have that forever. And he's not quite as quick now as he was maybe 7-8 years ago. But he's still, again, with all the assists he's put in, with the goals, I'm absolutely like flabbergasted and surprised. I not see the season from him coming whatsoever under in a club that's not always conducive to, like, if you're struggling with various bits, like going to Marseille will rarely make it easier. Like, it's not one of those clubs where you go to fix your stuff. It tends to be more of a club that really tests you. And I kind of want to just send this play a quick wall pass back over to Jonathan, because I'm curious about, like, where did this come from? Because he looks such a dramatically different player and character to the player we saw towards the end of his time at Arsenal in particular.
I mean, I think sort of the main source of this renaissance that Aubameyang is going through is he had to step up. You know, you look at the Marseille squad, there's not really anybody else in that group, you know, that can be sort of, you know, held to account as much as Aubameyang, presumably as the highest paid player, if not one of the sort of top two or three. And you know, he was expected to fill, as Andy said at the start of the segment, you know, quite a significant void in filling in for Alexis Sanchez, who also, you know, sort of enjoyed, you know, the last of the summer wine on the Canebière. So it's, yeah, I mean, I think it was necessity more than anything is probably the answer that I'm looking for, that Aubameyang had no choice but to perform because, you know, Marseille's form had gone into the crapper and, you know, with it, their hopes of getting into Europe through the league, unless PSG win the Coupe de France now, and that sort of growing sense of seriousness, which has been assuaged a little bit by a very underrated stint from Jean-Louis Gasset in charge of Marseille, you know, and has allowed them to kind of put the flames out. But literally at one point, you know, Aubameyang was sort of fighting to keep this Marseille side even treading water. And I think sort of just, you know, by being the most experienced and arguably the most talented player in that squad, you know, he had no choice but to perform. And I don't think maybe even he himself expected that he would be able to perform at the level that he has been performing. But also once he'd gotten on top of sort of his fitness and form issues that, like I said, took a couple of months to get over at the beginning of the season.
Well, we hope that has whetted your appetite for some unstable, unpredictable football at the weekend. So it's just about time, fellas, with that in mind, for me to ask you for your games of the week and food accompaniment. JJ, would you like to lead us out of the gate?
I mean, I am going to be very biased as a Villa fan, and I'm going to say that I'm really glued to Brighton Villa. It's a way for Brighton, I think, to salvage what's been quite a difficult second half of the season, but could obviously be a massive thorn in Unai Emery's side. So I am going to go for Brighton Villa and fish and chips. Look at me.
I mean, I'm not sure that there is anything more European than De Zerbi versus Emery over fish and chips, Lars. So you've got quite a tall bar to hit.
I mean, that's a disgraceful choice. I mean, what's happening? I know you're a fan, but come on. Not having that from Jonathan, very, very bad. I've gone full Tuchel on Kim here, but, you know, fair enough. Listen, for me, this is slightly unusual for me, but I'm doing it. I'm going full hipster and heading to the second tier. I'm going to the second Bundesliga, where, unless I'm completely mistaken, I believe Sampaoli can seal promotion on Friday night. Okay. I love Friday night games anyway, because they don't interfere with the rest of your sort of weekend plans. I'm one of those crazy people who thinks sitting inside watching a football game is a very good way to spend Friday night. That's just how I roll. But Sampaoli can seal promotion on Friday night against Hamburg, against HSV, who are still messing about in the second tier. They're fourth. They're not going to get directly promoted. They have a chance of making the playoffs still. But yeah, it could be another season in the second tier for Hamburg SV, with Sampaoli being able to seal promotion against their dreaded arch rivals. What a night that will be in Hamburg either way. And I'm going to, from memory, I think sort of Northern Germany, Hamburg, I think they eat a dish that we quite like in Norway as well, which is called Lapskaus, which is kind of a stew, which has various things in it. A little bit not too dissimilar from like the Scouse that you would get in Liverpool, I believe. That's a dish, isn't it? Yeah, Lapskaus, which is kind of a stew, very mysterious-looking brown stew with bits of meat and things in it. Not a feast for the eyes, but a fine, hearty meal, which will set you up for whatever's going to happen in Hamburg on Friday night after that game, which I expect is quite a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to say what is going to happen after that game on Friday night in Hamburg. Suffice to say that the last time I was at a game in St. Pauli, I tripped over an empty bottle of Jägermeister on my way into the stadium. I'm going to grant myself host privileges, recommending a game as well. Saturday night, Sassuolo, who've had a terrible fall from grace, as we were hearing from Nicky the other week. They are at 7:45 UK time playing at home to Inter, who, of course, have already won the league. Sassuolo desperately need the points against the champions, who, of course, now can't reach the high watermark set by Antonio Conte's Juventus team in terms of points, although they can still get to 100. That is also free to air in the UK on ITV, so worth having a little look at, I would say. And, well, they're not exactly sourdough this season, Sassuolo. I mean, they're pretty much frozen pizza, aren't they? I think we're looking at a supermarket's own margarita for that one, and hope for better times ahead. But thanks so much for joining us on OTC this week. Make sure you join us again tomorrow for Ask OTC, where we'll be answering all of your questions about the latest news from the world of European football. And make sure to subscribe in your podcast app so that you never miss an episode.
On the Continent is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.